On the 6th of August, Health Minister Andrew Little spoke to delegates at the Conference for General Practice. Later that afternoon, health reporter Martin Johnson caught up with Mr. Little in his office at the Beehive.
I think the system can be smarter. Support we can provide GPs to do, support them better in things like telehealth. I mean, I guess people keep pointing out to me how during COVID-19, plenty of GPs tell me this, they adapted pretty quickly to be able to do more consults online, telephone, and what have you. But everything is slipping back into kind of always doing stuff. So I think there's certainly scope for that, but that's got to come with appropriate support. But I certainly wouldn't be telling GPs how and when to do their job. There's a shortage of them, and there are gaps that we have to work with them to fill.
Now, you mentioned the shortage then. Perhaps we could dive into that. What sort of advice do you have about the shortage, and have you got any ideas for dealing with it?
Well, there's the short-term and the long-term stuff. The long-term stuff is getting more New Zealanders into learning and training, and then on the postgraduate stuff, making sure that there are places available. And I think the other part of the dialogue that is opening up too is about, for that postgraduate year one and year two kind of training, is exposure. And I think it was raised this morning, exposure to a wider range of things. It's not just what's in the hospital, it's in the community. So more time doing some time in the community and community practices, GP practices, as part of that postgraduate training period. That's the longer term stuff. The shorter term stuff is, you know, how do we fill these gaps? Health is just a standing exemption when it comes to people crossing the border from overseas. So part of the challenge is coordinating that, given that even if you can't cross the border, you've still got to get through NIQ and what have you. So I know the ministry is helping a number of practices coordinate new to New Zealand doctors to navigate that sort of process. So we're just going to have to continue to do that. Beyond GPs, and I know that there's a massive number of vacancies amongst nurses, also at the other end, senior clinicians and what have you, that's a little hard. I mean, overseas recruitment is one. We've been told to stop recruiting from countries where there is a strong need in those own countries. But when it comes to nurses, we know that there are some who have left the profession kind of more recently, in the last 5 years, who, with the right conditions and the right circumstances, might be encouraged to come back for a further period. So, look, it's just exploring all those sorts of opportunities.
We ran a reader poll recently about GP shortages, workforce shortages, and interestingly, a strong response was that the ministry bears a primary responsibility for making sure there's enough GPs. I'm not sure that that's self-evidently true. However, that's what people thought. I wonder whether there's more that the system can do to make general practice continue to be attractive. A lot of GPs say, you know, there's a lot of things about how the system operates that makes it unattractive, so that's perhaps partly one reason why younger ones don't come through.
The things that I hear are about funding. So doctors, the most common issue they raise is there's a whole lot of stuff they do they're not funded for. Then there's the fact that, you know, they're more complex conditions being presented, and older people that take longer than a 15-minute consult to have to deal with. So the funding formula is not keeping up with the reality of the profession. So there's those elements of it. I just think that because of the shortage, the doctors who are in practice are under immense pressure. So if you're looking at it from the outside, for an aspirant doctor looking at it, thinking, gee, why would I want to put myself under that sort of pressure? So it does not look very attractive. So there's a bit of a vicious circle operating here that we have to find a way to break somehow. Yeah, in terms of the ministry being responsible, I'm not sure. I think one of the things that Health NZ can help with, not just with the hospital end of the healthcare spectrum, and they'll have primary care commissioning responsibilities, is they will be in a better place, I think, to do the long-term workforce planning stuff and be thinking about, so in 10 years' time, what do we expect, what are we going to be needing? Have we got the things in place now to do that? You know, I think about what we're doing in mental health, about future workforce, and so we funded all these scholarships and extra training. But the reality is that's not going to bear fruit for another 6 or 7 years yet. But that's the time frame you have to be thinking in. Whoever wasn't doing it, somebody wasn't doing the thinking a few years ago about what now kind of looks like, and preparation, you know, wasn't made for it.
You mentioned funding. So what progress can you share on any review or analysis of primary care funding? I think you've said before that advice is being prepared.
It will be later this year, so it is still in train. I'm not expecting anything till towards later this year, so there's nothing further I can say about that.
Do you think new funding arrangements for primary care will be in place by the 1st of July next year, or will the PHO services agreement continue for the foreseeable future?
Look, I can't really commit to anything in that regard. Even if we do get to a point where we think, yep, there's got to be an improvement in the funding formula and the way we do that, it's still got to be negotiated through the usual sort of budget process. There will be a lot of demands as we set up the transition post 1 July, a lot of things that we'll be wanting to do to, you know, to set up right. I definitely detect there is a need to look more closely at what we're doing. I think there almost certainly is a case for change, but we've got to get that and then we're going to negotiate it, and I just can't put a timetable on that.
The funding question is about the amount of funding, but it's also about type of contracting and other things.
Yeah.
One of which is that the Simpson final report recommended, if I read it right, a different divvying up of primary care funding and at least 20% weighting for Māori and Pacific Island communities. Also, I could add that the Ministry and Primary Health Services Agreement, I mean, a protocol, PSAP, it's called, put up 2 years in a row budget bids for ethnicity funding or weighting and old age categories and deprivation weightings.
So those are all the factors. I mean, you know, when I talk to those doing the commissioning and the DHBs for primary care, that's the stuff they're talking about. They say those are where the gaps are. There's no waiting for those sorts of factors. And actually there should be. If you think about, you know, Counties Manukau commissioning primary health care for South Auckland, there's huge issues there. And yet defining issues in those communities are not factors to be taken into account in funding. So those are the very issues that are under consideration at the moment.
So it's just still watch this space. You're going to receive advice on it, but nothing to share about it at the moment.
Until there are decisions by Cabinet colleagues and others, I'm simply not in a position to, but you can be sure that those issues are under active consideration right now.
Which circles us back to what you identified before as, you know, I agree, obviously, funding of primary care being a reason which is undermining the workforce issues.
Yeah, exactly. The more constraints they're under, then the more difficult it is for them to fulfil their role. I think the other thing that's coming to the fore as well, and it'll be relevant for funding as well, is what does the modern practice, average sort of practice look like in terms of what's on offer? Is it just GPs and a practice nurse or practice nurses? How do we use nurse practitioners? How do we use other allied health professionals? It's interesting, some of the conversations I'm having with doctors in practice now is there's a lot of people really thinking seriously, what is a sustainable practice look like? Because it might not be the way a lot of practices look at the moment. You know, it's still the old model of some doctors and practice nurses and that's it. So I think there's some big questions there that have to be contended as well.
Who's that led by? Led by the sector or led by the ministry?
I think it's a bit of both, but I think it's a question that I expect will come up as a commissioning question eventually when we get into kind of more routine commissioning under the new structure.
Have you had any more thoughts or advice on how commissioning will work in primary care, particularly how it will be separated to be kept away from hospital services?
The issue of locality planning networks, there's preparation now for pilots that will start pretty much at the beginning of next year on how that will look. So processes for that, which is involving both the health services community in an area plus the community representatives, including iwi, bringing those processes together will have their own dynamic that I think will help. But in terms of how that is managed as against what Health NZ or the regional bodies will be doing in relation to funding their secondary and tertiary services, that's all yet to be worked out.
A lot of it sort of still seems quite a long time away. I think you mentioned this morning something about first locality plans to be revealed early 2022, is that right?
Yeah, I think the places where the pilots are going to be will be revealed, and then the processes will be get underway for just trying out what it looks and feels like in the first part of next year.
The locality plans themselves are another year after that?
I expect they'll come together more quickly than that. I think the question will be, because then people will be wanting to know, even by July next year, so what are the localities that we're talking about? We talk about locality planning, so what are the localities going to look like? And I'm not sure we would even have all the localities identified by 1 July next year, but we will start to have an idea about what works and what doesn't. Because I think then we'll have to give some very careful consideration to what are the most kind of sensible boundaries for a particular locality. So that stuff's all in train at the moment.
Are the localities going to be a thing? Are they going to be an organisation, or are they sort of going to be an idea?
more an idea, I think. I mean, one of the issues we're grappling with this too is the Māori Partnership Boards. They will have a view about their jurisdiction, for want of a better term, their rohe, and how that interfaces with the locality planning networks. Do we have kind of one iwi Māori Partnership Board for one kind of locality? The reality is iwi boundaries are, you know, more fluid and tend to follow a different pattern to kind of the, some of the way we've set up regions for a lot of the government bureaucracy. So we want those things to be meaningful. Obviously, we need the engagement between iwi and Māori to be meaningful. So there's a bit of work to do to work out those relationships too.
That brings up something that came up after you left this morning in the session that was attended by Stephen McKernan, where he spoke. Sue Kringle talked about the Māori Health Authority, and she talked about it very much as an arm of the Crown, not a partnership representative. What do you think about that?
The idea is it's got to be independent, and the way we're setting it up is the steering group is well independent of the Crown. They've been running the recruitment process and the nomination process completely independent of the rest of the bureaucracy and ministers. And actually, it's worked, I think it's worked really well, and we're trying to find a way to preserve that as a permanent feature of it.
Oh, sorry, how do you mean it? Preserve it as a permanent feature?
A standard government recruitment process, we go through the Public Service Commission, and so if we're setting up a DHB, apart from the elected members, but Public Service Commission and the Ministry will run a recruitment process and we'll get all these sorts of people. Actually, what has worked really well and given confidence to Māori, I think, is that, you know, we had Tā Mason, he assembled his group and he consulted over that, and they're a group that have a lot of confidence. They've gone away and run the process. They've done the interviews, they've sought expressions of interest, they've done the interviews, they've come up with a set of nominations and kind of presented it to Penny Hennard and me. And I think it's a good group, you know, so why would we want to change this? This is a good thing. I mean, it's very important that Māori Health Authority has the confidence of Māori. It's got to do that. And it will do that when it has an independence from the Crown, but a relationship with the Crown. You know, there is a fertile debate in Te Ao Māori about whether the Māori Health Authority can be, should be, or could be the treaty partner. That's a debate in the Māoridom. And look, they will have continued to have that dialogue. We'll see where that goes, but it's got to have independence. It's got to be free to, you know, do its own, conduct its own work, research. Oh, it's going to have independent commissioning powers, or like co-commissioning powers with Health NZ. But above all, it's got to operate in a way that maintains the confidence of Māori, and we've got to make sure it does that.
So does this work on the accountability arrangements for the iwi Māori partnership boards? So the same question arises there, I suppose, if they're expected to be accountable to the Crown, does that make them a Crown agency?
Yeah. I mean, because there's obviously this public money that the Māori Health Authority is going to be responsible for. In terms of the discussions with Tā Mason and his group, there's no denial that there is a level of accountability for that to the Crown. But actually, what they want to talk about and what we're talking to them about is their accountability to Māori. There's got to be an accountability relationship to Māori. They've got to be working on realising the aspirations and ambitions of Māori. So that's got to be built into it. And I think actually where we're getting to is, I'd have to describe it as a hybrid kind of thing, but it might be different to any other Crown entity we've got at the moment, because it's got the number of things that it has to do and be is different to any other Crown entity we've got at the moment. We get close to, with Te Mata Tini, the Māori Language Commission might come close to it, but this is a service funder and advocate in a way that no other kind of agency is. So there might be quite a unique arrangement for the Māori Health Authority.
Then just turning to perhaps your relationship with primary care, forgive me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like an element of defensiveness crept into your response this morning with Dr. Hill from Palmerston North on the socioeconomic determinants of health.
I had a really good conversation with David afterwards. And I met David before, and he's very good. He's outstanding and have a lot of respect for him. But I had addressed the social determinant and said, health, what we're doing in health doesn't stand alone. I painted the picture of all the other things the government's doing, because we have a view that it's, you can't just do bits here and bits there. There's a package of stuff, and that to some extent reflects a level of neglect for a long time. So to the extent that he was raising issues on the basis that I wasn't aware of them or we weren't addressing them, I think that was a little problematic. That said, his view is a perfectly orthodox view. And when we talked about it afterwards, we agreed on it. We agreed on it all. I think he would like us to be moving at a faster pace. I think the comment he made was, whatever you're doing, it's not having an impact. It was a bit of a blunt comment, and I disagree with it. It is having an impact. And the priority we've given to employment, keeping people in jobs and generating jobs, clearly is having an impact, as the figures this week show. So I'm very pleased about what we're doing, and I engage with the GP community through their representatives, through SAM and through the Medical Association and through others. So I think I do have an awareness of their particular challenges too. Like all of these things, it does take time to remedy some of these issues that have taken a long time to emerge.
So then would it be wrong to characterise that characteristic of difficulty in getting a message across to primary care?
I think so many health professions, and whether it's in primary care, whether it's in hospitals and that, are just really feeling the pressure at the moment. And and as the surveys show, people feeling stressed and feeling burnt out. And so, people do look around and say, well, what needs to be different? And people have got their ideas and they express them very clearly. But I think, sometimes people with very, very clear and firm ideas they wish to articulate are not perhaps seeing that actually there is stuff being done that does address some of those issues. It might not be as fast and as furious as they want, but there's plenty of stuff being done, and it does take a time for those things to have an impact. So David's question, the points he raised, is totally on song with actually what we're trying to do.
A number of times I've heard you say in interviews, me and others, you raised views about single practitioner, general practitioners. You seem to have a bit of a distaste for that. Do you want to expand on that? And do you not see a place for the many of these practitioners who exist in the system of the future?
Which is single practitioner mean?
Yeah, you've talked about single general practitioners or small general practices, is what you're talking about, I think, as opposed to, you seem to have a liking for a sort of a more corporate model of general practice with more integrated services.
No, it's not more. I wouldn't describe it as corporate. I just think the reality of the way healthcare is given is that, the GP can't do everything and shouldn't be expected to do everything. And I think the other thing is we have trained healthcare professionals who are not GPs, but who can do stuff, some of which are stuff that GPs currently do. I just think if we're thinking about the health needs of a population, whatever it is, however defined, whatever its profile is, it's about making sure we have health services that respond effectively to those health needs. And I'm not sure in this day and age a GP practice, whether it's a 1, 2, 6, whatever GPs and some nursing assistants, is enough to meet modern healthcare needs of a community. People are going to need other, need a variety of things. And I think it's also about saying the GP provides their incredible range of skills, very good at kind of looking at the whole body and the whole kind of health profile of a person. That not everybody who comes through the door to a GP practice needs that every time. Sometimes it is just, it might be a low-level flu or whatever else. It's a routine vaccination. You don't need the GP to be across all that, but you need staff who are skilled and competent to be able to address those sorts of issues. So I think part of it is saying to GPs is, to think about, as kind of health leaders in a community, how do they make sure without burning themselves out and expecting everybody to demand everything off them, how do they think we can, or they can, make provision for the kind of the range of healthcare demands that people now have in a community? There'll be in small communities, small intimate practices, will be the right thing. In bigger communities and metropolitan areas, actually a bit of scale might not be a bad thing, particularly if it means that doctors can be more flexible about, being available over between them a longer range of hours, being able to offer more services and being able to get some economies of scale.
Final thing, immigration and this issue of the residency queue, this issue that seems to have built up a bit of a head of steam beyond general practice as well, particularly in general practice.
Yeah.
And you saw this morning, you commented on it at the conference, the 50% of the room who stood up and said they had vacancies and patients couldn't get appointments. Is there more that the government can do to address those immigration related issues?
Look, I'm in discussion with the immigration minister, and we are, and cabinet is as well apprised of the issue. We do want to see something, and particularly in healthcare, and it won't be just in healthcare, there's other sort of skill areas too, but particularly in healthcare with the vacancies we've got and the pressure that the system is under, we do need to find a way through this. And particularly, people have been here for a while who would ordinarily be on a pathway to residency now. The kind of total slowdown is, we're going to put them at risk, risk of leaving because they'll find a better offer somewhere. I get letters from some of those people saying how much they love it here, they want to stay here, they're committed to here, and so why wouldn't we be seizing that with both hands? So look, that dialogue is well underway.
Is it to do with the immigration minister's announcement of a sort of a review or reset of immigration policy generally? Is it caught up there?
Now, after COVID, everything slowed down. Part of it is the thing, immigration, the policy advice, given that borders are closed, we're going to be careful that we don't have the whole system tilted in favour of a small number of sectors or industries, a sense that there has to be some fairness in the distribution of people coming across the border on a permanent sort of basis, which might be kind of good in theory, but the reality is there is a need now, and people who have made a contribution and wish to continue to make a contribution, but with the certainty of residency, are on hold, and they want to make long-term choices for their lives, and that approach is not helping. So I think we just accept that reality and find a way through.
I think we've had two stories in the last week about GPs who've recently gone back, Otaki and Whangarei.
And I've met GPs who are in a similar situation. I'm not going to comment on individual cases, but you know, I'm aware of that, and as I say, we're working on it.
That was health reporter Martin Johnson speaking to Andrew Little on the 6th of August 2021 for New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa.